Case 79 from the Book of Serenity. Changsha Advancing a Step. Introduction. The Bodhisattva appearing as a maiden on the banks of golden sand was a special spirit. Stuffing pastries in a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? Without going into frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. How about one expression of walking relaxed with big strides? The main case. Changsha had a monk, asked Master Hui. How was it before you saw Nanshuan? Hui remained silent. The monk said, how about after seeing him? Hui said, nothing special. The monk returned and related this to Changsha. Changsha said, the man sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, this is not yet the real. Atop the 100-foot pole, he should step forward. The universe in all directions is the whole body. The monk said, atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward? Changsha said, the mountains of Lang, the rivers of Li. The monk said, I don't understand. Changsha said, the whole land is under the imperial sway. The verse, the jade man's dream is shattered. One call from the rooster. Looking around on life, all colors are equal. Wind and thunder, the news of events, roust out the hibernating insects. Peach trees, wordless, naturally make a path. When the time and season comes, laboring at the plow, who fears the spring rose, knee-deep mud? So it's our tradition here in Boundless Way as we practice together in this way, do this training, that we investigate some case or some text. In this case, this koan is from a collection called the Book of Serenity that was compiled in the 12th century by Hungjer. A wonderful Dharmalite, and we read one of his writings this morning in our sutra service. And we take up these stories as entry point into our own life. Changsha, according to the story, was a Dharma heir of Nanshuan, a great teacher in the Tang dynasty, and this hermit, Master Hui. So Changsha sends his monk to this hermit, and reportedly this hermit is also a student of Nanshuan's and received transmission from Nanshuan, as Changsha did. So these are two Dharma brothers. One sending a monk to check up on the other. Of course, maybe all of us would like to send a monk to check up on the other people in the Dharma hall. How are you doing? How was it for you before the sutra service? How about after? And these questions of before and after, of course, these are our human questions. These amazing minds we have that create time. We create a life. We can conceive of the past. All of us come here today with some story. The story we call by our own name. I call my story David. Before and then after all imagining, how will it be later this morning, this afternoon? Will I make it to rest period? Will I finally this retreat? Will I finally get it? Wanting something. We all come here wanting something. This is not good and not bad, we might say. Without this wanting, without this thirsting desire, we would not practice. This imagining there is something we might get is both the greatest lie. This imagining, this mind that thinks that there is somewhere else, there is something else. And yet, there is something else. There is something that is so precious, something of such value that each one of us would mark these dates off on our calendar and would come to do this, what I think may be the most difficult thing for a human being to do, to meet ourself. I've met some difficult people in the world, but no one comes close to me in terms of the problems of my life. So here we are, facing ourselves, everything that arises. The characters in this story are us. And so the monk asks, how is it after you saw Nanchuan? So how is it after you received transmission? How is it after your great insight? How is it after your great disappointment? And quite wonderfully, the monk says, nothing special.
So the three of us agreed that we would each do a small Dharma talk about this case, both days. And now it's my turn. And I want to just echo a few of the things David said, even though my temptation is to say, yes, that most difficult person, it is David. But that's an easy laugh, because I really know the dark secret is that it's me, and every one of us would admit this. When we first hear these koans, some of you may have heard many, many koans, have worked with koans, played with koans over years or maybe months. Maybe this is the first koan you've ever heard, which is possible. They don't really make that much sense at first. And if we try to understand them with our discursive mind, with the mind that makes me, the me who gets things, who figures things out, will be very far from the understandings that the compilers of the Book of Serenity brought into their care of writing the pointers. The poem is by Hongzhi. And I love the piece that we read today by Hongzhi about how wonderful the world is. Not necessarily what we feel on a moment-to-moment basis. Certainly it's hard to hear the news. It's hard to hear the news outside or the news that we hear in our own heads as we sit at a sesshin from the inside. It doesn't seem like things are so easy. And as David said, it's important to immerse ourselves in these koans, not from an intellectual place, but from the yearning place, the wanting something beyond the mind that explains the world to us, and that always falls short in its explanations because the world is not explainable. Although we do try, don't we, over and over. So when David was reading the koan, two lines jumped out at me that I'd like to play around with a little bit before I pass the koan over to Josh. And one is this monk who Changsha sets up in a way to send him to Master Wei. And Master Wei is, according to the investigation we did last night, which didn't take very long and was pretty leisurely and relaxed, it wasn't a scholarly investigation, there's not that much that's known about him other than that he was a Dharma heir of Nanchuan, and that in the eminent biographies of Zen masters of the Tang and Sung, he comes last and has just a couple of lines. He was somebody who didn't become a great teacher in the sense that he didn't become a public teacher. He was a hermit. He took his insights and kept them to himself. And Changsha wanted to challenge him and sent this poor monk to ask these questions and then report back. And then after all of this, Changsha recites the beautiful poem, which is also used in another koan in the Gateless Gate, about the man on top of the 100-foot pole who needs to take a step. And the monk says, well, but he's of course using his ordinary mind, I don't get it. Like, you're up on a pole, how do you take a step forward? That doesn't make any sense. You'd be walking in the air. We can only imagine what he was thinking about this. And Changsha gives him one of these wonderful Zen answers, which if the first time you hear these things, if you think you know what they mean, good luck with that. He says, the mountains of Lang and the rivers of Li, you know, and our intellect can figure this out. He's saying, oh, it's just everywhere. But the monk isn't satisfied with that. And he says, I don't understand. And this is the line that I think is so precious. I don't understand. I don't understand why the world is the way it is. Somebody asked me the other day in a context where she was talking about the great suffering that's present now in the world and has always been present in the world, the great suffering in her own life, diseases that are arising for this person. And she said to me, but why? Why do you think this is happening to me? Because we really want to know. We want to know why people take guns and go into schools. We want to know why people bomb other people, why people are unkind to other people, how we participate in this ourselves through our own ignorance. We want to know. We want to understand. But at the bottom of everything is this simple monk who just got batted around between two very different Zen teachers, a very public Zen teacher who speaks beautifully and is famous, many stories about Changsha, and this other person, this obscure person sitting in his cave. I don't understand. So how do we come to understand? There's a little bit of a hint in the other compiler of this text. I think his name was Wangsong. I might be wrong about that. He does an introduction to the case, and I love this line, without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a suitable fish. It's one of those lines that just brings a smile to my face when I think about a suitable fish. What is he talking about? Again, I don't understand. What is a suitable fish? But I do understand what it means to go into the frightening waves. We can protect ourselves. We can stay on the top of a 100-foot pole. We can shroud ourselves in Zen as a protection from the world. But that's not what Zen is for, at least not the way we understand it. Zen is for taking that longing and that not knowing and bringing it forth by taking a step away from the known. A big step. Going into the frightening waves of reality. The way the world presents itself to us. The outer waves of war and slaughter and unkindness on the deepest level. Of confusion. Of grief. To head into those waves, to find not more suffering, but what is true in the middle of being fully within suffering, which Wang San calls a suitable fish. Tasty.
I'm so pleased to be amid these scary waves with so many suitable fish. I don't know what these unsuitable fish are. So, this practice atop the flagpole, we take our little mind and we put it in we take our little body and put it in a little teeny space right here on the top of the flagpole. And we really just try to hold it there. This is a very challenging practice. There's all these winds, there's all these waves, and there's all this world unfolding. And we are trying to keep to our little selves on top of that flagpole. Now, it's not that there's no value up there. We get a good view. We get a little bit of a bird's eye view of the lay of the land. We get a sense of the rising and falling of stories, reactions, aversions, graspings. Another image for this. And these are valuable insights. The role of insights is not that we always are actively having them right now. Please don't be like that. So insights, if there's the waves of a lake, when the wind gets very still, the silt of the lake settles out, we see down to the bottom of the lake. We see something true and important. And it's apparent to us because of causes and conditions, the circumstances that have led to the stilling of the wind, the settling of the silt. And in that moment, we see for ourselves the truth of this practice. Now, the purpose is not that the wind never comes up and the waves never get roiled up into white water and mud. When that happens, as it will, Having seen down to the bottom, we have a capacity to entrust ourselves to that, especially when it's not apparent. Having gotten the bird's eye view, then when we step forward into the big mess of life, we're able to encounter this terrain, rising and falling, all of these terrifying waves, all of these suitable and unsuitable fish. The invitation of this koan is to allow the entirety of the world to be our body, to allow the entirety of the world to be our mind. Everything, meeting it, not trying to still it, not trying to rise above it. As Hongzhe said in the piece we read, turning toward what we've been excluding and integrating it. Letting it all in. Stepping off the cliff of the known, off the cliff, off the flagpole of the familiar. And then the whole world is your total body. So we want to invite folks to come forth in Dharma dialogue. Questions, comments, resonances, flagpoles.
And please feel free to sit comfortably. And how lovely and challenging to let things be as they are. You know, sometimes in our desire, we have images of how other people should feel. And this kindness, I think, towards ourself, as all kinds of emotions come up. I want to go, I don't want to go, doing well, not doing well. Instead of trying to regulate. Partner, wife says, I don't want you to go. And that's just how it is. Not something to be fixed or controlled. And we get in the car. Yeah.
Okay. And it's so hard to get to Sesshin. And being at Sesshin, it's so hard to stay. And staying, it's so hard to come back. And I recently came across a little comment of between two recent Zen teachers. One of them said, they're talking about Sesshin, and the only thing harder than going to Sesshin is not going to Sesshin.
So it's always interesting how these stories unfold over the several days we're here, and so I'm sure that on another day I won't feel this way. But today, I find myself in a lot of sympathy with the hermit, who is impatient of all the forms and he wants to be in a place where he can, in a way, always be on Sesshin, and this annoying student, you know, and he ignores the first question to just let him know, not a, you know, you either answer that for yourself or don't ask me to. And then the other one, not such a bad answer, nothing special. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. What, you know, the student, you know, well, you know, when I grow up, I want to be enlightened, what's it like? And nothing special. So so I like that part of the story, and I'm resisting, you know, jumping right to the teacher back at home saying, oh, that guy. That's what he always does. Yeah, right. He's got to get that 100-foot pole out of his, you know.
Nice image.
Just a little. Maybe a little Dharma sibling rivalry there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and you know, there's a way, we were talking about this a little bit last night too, there's a way to understand this koan as nobody's criticizing anybody. They're just presenting two very different forms of people who are awake. Right? So one person who's awake is staying, I'm staying in the cave. You know, I'm not going out of the cave. This is enough for me. Because everybody's constructed so differently. And you're right, his answer, nothing special, it's a wonderful answer. It's the title of one of Joko Beck's books, right? Mm. Nothing Special. And that's an important teaching. And of course, it's not, any teaching, anything we say in words doesn't have the other side to it, which is one reason I really like this koan a lot, personally, that it really does present both as valid ways of being. We're using a translation by one of the Cleary brothers, and he in his translation, the one we use in Boundless Way is nothing special, but in his translation he says there couldn't be anything else, which I think is a really great line. You know, this is it right here. It's like somebody on the top of the 100-foot pole. You know, yeah, I'm going to take a step. But right now, I'm on the top of the pole. Thank you very much. So, and it is, I love what Josh said about the fish. You know, that where are the unsuitable fish? Could there be any unsuitable fish? I don't know if there are any unsuitable fish. But every fish presents itself uniquely.
I was just appreciating how one way to look at this too is that even in nothing special we can get attached to that, you know, this incredible capacity of our minds to create something out of whatever it is, so we can make nothing special something quite special. Oh, nothing special. I'm fine. So how to create the capacity for flexibility? And I think part of that is not having to take sides, as Melissa was saying. So when nothing special, when hermit, we step into the hermit, how to fully manifest that and really appreciate the life of the hermit. I will not go outside my house today, right? But not as a fixed position, as a momentary apparition, fully correct, fully suitable.
And from this perspective of no incorrect anywhere, how quick we all are to take other beings as referenda on ourselves. And what if that's not true?
Julie's got her hand up.
Okay. Julie, and then here.
Just an observation. The lines that stuck with me are the stuff in pastries in a crystal bowl.
Yeah.
Just roll it around. Just totally imagined. No, you know, makes no sense at all. And yet how familiar that is to me. It's exactly what kind of thing comes up when I'm like half asleep and I'm trying to figure something out, and I think I have to figure out how to roll this crystal ball, you know. I mean, there's something very familiar about this kind of just very random thing. That's just my...
I love that association.
Great. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
This is, for me, my first session, and for me, it's the bike stepping off. But it is really nothing special, because it's still me. I'm making mistakes. I tore my card in half before. I'm helpless at Oriolki, and I'll get better. And some things I do well, and some things I don't do well, and it's just me here.
Yep. Yeah. But
thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you know, the opportunity to realize this is I think what the Hermit Way is pointing to, right? It is just this. There isn't in that, so there couldn't be anything else. Tearing my card in half, you know, where does a spoon go? When do you turn it up? When do you lick it? I don't get this. It's to really own that fully is what we're, in a way, aiming for. We're aiming to come here, because there isn't any other place. But when we're in the other place, we'll be there. And I love what you said, that so I'll get better.
Yeah.
Maybe not. but it is this, we enter these things
I'll
with...
I'll make another mistake.
I think you can count on that. Yes, and that is one of our wonderful reassuring statements in Zen, that a life in Zen is one continuous mistake. I think that word continuous is very important. We say it a lot. Never ending. Because really, even when we've done something, you know, I got the Oriolki down, I remembered when to bow, I turned to the right direction, then we're making some kind of a fixed position about that. It's just constantly in flux. You know, when are those pastries going to come out of that jar? I don't know. And why am I rolling it? And where's the fish? What kind of a meal is this? Okay. But anyway, thank you, Bill, for saying that.
And it's just... me here now. Long ago in another vocational incarnation, I worked with people with severe brain injuries. And one of them was a person who kind of just is a kind of sing-song mantra. One of the only things that he said was, "Here now, me." And I think this he was maybe using this as an anchor, and maybe using it as a way of opening to the world as his total body. Here now, me.
I'm going to try this.
Laura.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate the all the talks and the one talk and the suitable fish, unsuitable fish, and what leapt into my mind was how easy it can be to believe that stepping off the pole is better than staying on it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That this, the way that I heard the the talk was, so there's the best way to do this, or the only way to do this is to step off the pole.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's so easy for me to get caught in there's only one best way, or one right way, or, you know, and who's to say that stepping off the pole is better than staying on the pole, and where one can find suitable fish and unsuitable fish.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I was thinking, too, about this pole, that so the traditional understanding is that this pole is some kind of elevated position and some kind of insight, and we get stuck. But Alan points to another kind of pole that we can get stuck in. Yeah, I was very touched.
Very touched.
No crystal jar here. But we can get stuck on the pole of our opinion. So when things are going poorly, we are on that pole of, you know, whatever it is, whatever that life perspective is, and how fiercely we can cling to it. And I think, Laura, you point out that not bad, not a, you know, when we're clinging to life is terrible and it's not going to get better, it's just a place to be. And Josh's reference to, we can't make something else happen. Right? Because we get this idea, oh, stepping off the pole. Okay, this period, I'm going to step off the goddamn pole. You know? And it's just another idea. So all of these images, I think, partly are to befuddle us. So we're not so clear about what we're supposed to do. Some of us, like Paul, come in already befuddled. this structure, this form, is guaranteed to disorganize us all. Part of the gift of it, and it will even disorganize our disorganization. And where we get to the place of, oh, just here I am, on a pole, not a pole, inside, outside. I wonder what will happen next.
Yeah. I always think of this poem by Adrienne Rich, and I think I might try to look it up on the interweb and see if I can find it for tomorrow. But it's called Prospective Immigrants, Please Take Note. I just love the title. And it's about a door. And she says, here's this door, and you can either go through the door, or you can choose not to go through. And then she kind of paints the picture of what happens when you go through the door, which is a lot of befuddlement. Or you can stay on this side of the door. And it's the same theme that we're working, that both are noble endeavors, you know. And for everyone who's come to Sesshin, you've already gone through the door. Sorry, it's too late. You know, you can scramble a little bit, but then where do you go? You know, you could cling to the door sill, or you could take a little step. Or so everybody's going to do it differently. Every fish.
Mm-hmm. So there's someone.
There are a couple of people raised their hands.
Down on the right, I see the.
Okay. Yeah, it's Christine.
And then two. Yeah, Christine, and then Jeannie, and somebody else here.
Thank you so much. And what caught me in the talk, and it's been wonderful to hear everybody, is a little mind that tries to get everything. And what I felt in that moment is that's where I live. And the longer that I'm here, and the more I go into those waves or step off the pole, I'm not sure what word I would use, but I can't get anything, fix anything, and it feels amazing and terrifying, and I also, you know, and I can't even make a decision not to feel resistance before Sesshin, even as much as I love Sesshin, like Josh said. The only thing harder than going to Sesshin is not being here. The resistance comes up, and I'm like, well, all right, it is whatever.
Exactly. And then the resistance is that wave, that crashing wave. That's, you go into the resistance. You don't have to stop being, you have some, you know, kind of ideal Zen student. You are an ideal Zen student, just as you are. That's hard to believe.
And I was honest when I got here about somebody asked me how I was, and I said, well, I'm feeling a lot of resistance. And then I encountered a lot of people who were sharing that, and it felt like, oh, you know, another mask off, at least for this moment.
One time a Sangha member asked me if he was doing Sesshin wrong because he didn't dread it as much as everybody else seemed to.
And that goes back to Alan's comment, like, who knows what you'll how you'll hear things tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, again, no fixed position.
Yeah. So Jeannie, and then Lily.
So Josh has used the image of the clear lake before, and I love that clear lake. It took me a pretty long time to realize that that's one of my major addictions. You know, and it got me every time. You know, I'd go to Sesshin, I'd go through the being exhausted and screwing up, and then somehow the lake would get clear, and I got it. You know, even sometimes I'd go home and it would stick around for a couple of days. And then I'd get pissed off and it got all murky again. Like, yeah, it even happened sooner. You know, as soon as that clarity comes, I go, oh, shit. I really prefer this. So where I am now is, you know, it's sort of like, I gave up smoking, I gave up chewing gum, you know. And now I have to give up this most precious addiction. And where does it lead me? You know, no comfort, never, you know, no control. I think that's the bottom line. You know, I am not in control. I may really screw up a lot. Because I always had this illusion that if I had that clarity, I was all set. You know, even for a small amount of time. And now I realize that as soon as the clarity comes, I'm fucked.
And preferences are not in themselves a problem. It's when we make preferences into requirements that it becomes a problem. And when these things arise, this is part of what's included in being human. As it turns out, we suitable fish are.
Yeah. So Willie, and then Tim.
So you know, I'm peculiarly obsessed with motivations, and the story. I'm going like, well, the first teacher wakes up one morning and says, "Hey, I wonder how that old guy's doing," and sends his most annoying student to him. Is that what it's about? Or did he do it?
We make it our own story.
Did he do it for the benefit of the student, for the benefit of the guy in the cave, or what? I don't know what's going on here. You know, it doesn't make an enormous amount of sense. I mean,
Wait, you know, even if it started to make sense, I don't know how satisfying that would be. It just, these are the questions we hold. I don't understand. That's great. That's like you meet the not understanding the same way you meet the resistance, the same way we meet everything.
The not understanding is not a stand-in for the good stuff.
Right.
The not understanding is fully, fully, fully it. Here, now.
It seems to be a pattern in the koans, though. The sort of one teacher sends somebody else off to, they never go themselves. Well, maybe a few times they do, but mostly they send somebody else off to go see somebody else and sort of yank their chain.
So your chain has been yanked.
Yeah. Your sesshin is filled with crotchety characters, I know this.
Just one.
Yes. Yeah, good luck with him.
Yeah.
Thank you, Will.
Tim. One of the things that comes up for me, I've always had an affinity for the hermits. Because of being a painter and kind of hold up in our workspaces and shut the world out. I really think that he was talking to himself when he talked about going off the 100-foot fall. The thing that came up for me was a little poem by David Butteville. It says, "The hermit always picks up the phone on the first ring." I go to a certain point after a little while of working where I'm just moving around, bang. I think I need to go back among the people. So there's that. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but you were talking about him being attached to being a hermit. We can make something out of nothing special.
Right.
And I think there's some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the possibility to we say no fixed self, but actually many, many, many selves. Often we want to say, we imagine we know our motivation, going back to what Willie said. I mean, who knows what this guy was doing? Who knows what we're doing? You know, we make up these stories and then, 6 months or a year later we say, I actually, there was something else going on. So these many selves, and I think one of the things I so appreciate about Zen is that we're not talking about transcending the many selves. We're not talking about living in some removed height, but fully... in the end of the verse, it's so when the spring comes, no need to complain about holding the plow and having your feet wet. So when the spring comes, when it's time to paint and close out the world, can we be courageous enough to do that? And then can we be courageous enough to let that disappear when the time is ripe and enter into the one who... doesn't even wait for the phone to ring, but calls up a friend and says, "Hey, let's go watch a movie." Yeah.
And on this matter of many selves, the New Yorker recently had a cartoon that was, the caption of which was, "The Conga Line of Past Selves." And the beautiful thing for me, the beautiful thing about Zen is... the fact that the wrong motivation of every element of the conga line of my past selves has proved not to be a problem.
On that note of no problem.